I'm Robin Young. It's here and now. It could be weeks before electricity is restored to 3 million Floridians still without power after four hurricanes in 6 weeks pummeled the state. Late yesterday, the Bush administration asked Congress to approve another $7 billion to help Florida and other southeastern states recover from widespread flooding and damage left by Charlie, Francis, Ivan, and Jean. Especially vulnerable is Florida's elderly population, a significant number of whom call Charlotte County on Florida's west coast home. Deirdre Travis supervises senior services case managers in Charlotte County. Deirdre, how are senior citizens doing?
Right now, they're getting pretty tired. Storm after storm after storm. People are just starting to think, when is, you know, things going to be returning to normal?
And we understand 35% of the county population is seniors. That's twice the state average, and the state average is pretty high. I mean, for relative to other states, what has happened to the seniors? What are the problems?
Well, what we're finding is folks are pretty limited as far as where they can go if their home has been significantly damaged. We're taxing our assisted living facilities and nursing home facilities.
Are you seeing seniors having to go into nursing homes?
We actually are. We're looking at that hopefully as maybe a temporary thing so that we can get their homes buttoned up and get them back on track if they have homeowners insurance and get some repairs made. Mold certainly is a huge issue, and, you know, with sick elders, that's just not conducive to promoting their health.
Right. And do we understand that more seniors than people anticipated don't have insurance?
And that's true. Anybody who doesn't have a mortgage tends to believe that they really don't need homeowners insurance, not anticipating storms, since we've not had a storm on the West Coast here in many, many years. Mm. People have, you know, tapped into their savings. Mm-hmm. It doesn't take long, certainly, what you could build 30 years ago, and the costs have, you know, just skyrocketed.
Right, since they last bought a home, if you're 80 now, right?
That's true, right.
I understand that loans are being offered to people in place of cash assistance, but many elderly aren't applying because they don't want to be saddled with a loan. They may not be able to pay one off in the long term. Then they burden their family.
Well, and that's true. The loans generally are very low interest, and once these are explained, people really feel a little bit better about that.
Mm. I'm wondering what the health of some of these seniors is. We know that, you know, sometimes a real jolt at an older age can be devastating, not having your home is a real jolt. But what are some of the other health issues they're facing?
Well, what we're looking at is an awful lot of stress. I was talking to a friend of mine who's a doctor here in town, and they said they hadn't seen as many people coming in for, like, anxiety medications at this point. Certainly seniors have to be particularly careful with, you know, mixing medications for maybe heart conditions with something that's an antidepressant or an anti-anxiety.
And, of course, with no power, there's been no refrigeration, no air conditioning, tough for seniors. How else is the storm's aftermath affecting people in general?
From my information as of yesterday, it looks like we've got about 5,000 homes here in just Charlotte County alone that are going to have to be demolished. I know we've got folks that are waiting for a new roof to be put on their homes. We're being given dates of December. We could have, you know, some pretty good rainstorms between now and then. We still have people from August 13th is when Hurricane Charlie impacted this area. We still have people who are waiting for the Army Corps of Engineers to come in and initially tarp their homes. We've got several of our mobile home parks that they've brought in FEMA trailers, which really consist of a 35-foot camping trailer, which for people who are handicapped, that poses a few challenges. It's just this domino effect that we're having.
And I'm wondering, too, if, you know, Florida's future is perhaps jeopardized, its future, its place in the world as a place for snowbirds, as a place for retirement and the elderly. I'm wondering, you know, that might change.
You know, I'm not really sure about that. I have seen absolute amazing courage and strength. You know, you get the tears and you get the, wow, you know, how much more can I take? But these folks have been through an awful lot their entire lives, and this is kind of one more issue that they have to deal with, and so far I haven't seen any that haven't risen to the occasion.
Deirdre Travis, a supervisor in the Senior Services Department in Charlotte County, Florida. Deirdre, thank you.
You're very welcome.
The National Guard reports this week that for the first time in a decade, it has fallen short of its recruiting goals by 5,000 soldiers. The regular Army, on the other hand, reports that it will make its recruitment goals. But all arms of the military are looking warily at next year and an ongoing war. Dr. Kenneth Allard teaches national security studies at Georgetown University. He's now on sabbatical. He joins us from his home in Daphne, Alabama. And Dr. Allard, what is going on here? The Army and Army Reserve say they expect to meet their recruiting goals this year.
Yeah, the problem with this is the fact that they are looking very much at the immediate short-term goals, which always in recruiting, it's very much like the stock market. It's where you are right now. The thing that I think a lot of people have a problem with is thinking about where our manpower policy needs to be over the much longer term, because we have taken too much out of the reserve component, and we are basically beginning to have some difficulty in replacing it. And a lot of people think that trend will continue for some time.
Right. Well, explain something else to us, because even though the Guard fell short in its overall recruitment, we understand that the Army Guard is meeting its retention goal this year. In other words, reenlistments are higher in units that have already deployed to Iraq or Afghanistan than those that haven't.
Well, they know what they are facing, and there is something wonderful about, when you are dealing with certain knowns, you know you're going up against a known adversary, you know what you can do about that, eliminate some uncertainty. The major problem that we're facing right now with recruitment, as well in some ways as with retention, is the fact that people don't know how long they're going to be gone, how long they're going to be, or how many times they're going to be called up to go. And that is basically putting a lot of pressure right now on the services, active and reserve, to begin to do things like reduce tour lengths.
Well, you can't
do that without doubling the number of troops you have.
Well, in fact, we're going to be talking to a guardsman in a moment who's very concerned with that. He had no expectation that he would be in Iraq in the first place, and then as long as he ended up there in the second. But tell us, let's talk about tours of duty. Why is it, for instance, we understand the Army and the Marine Corps have different lengths of tour of duty?
Robin, if you want me to tell you that there is a Marine Corps way and an Army way of doing things, that's exactly what I'm going to tell you. I'm not going to say one is right and another is wrong. I'm simply saying that they basically reflect differing service priorities. The Marines are originally the short-term naval infantry. They go in on an expedition, they get the job done, they leave. Armies tend to stay for a much longer period of time, and so their time frame, their horizon, is a little bit different. Unfortunately, that reflects their histories, and those histories are in some respects very different. The problem right now is the fact that what they are both finding is that, you know, putting people over there for that length of time not only exposes them to some real hazards, but their families as well. And we are finding that since more of our components are out of the reserves, that's even more of a problem for them.
Right. But then we also hear that this idea of shortening the tours of duty, ferrying soldiers back and forth, also puts the soldiers in jeopardy, but also jeopardizes the mission in Iraq, because then you have people who have just gotten used to an area, perhaps made friends with Iraqis, and they're suddenly yanked out. We saw that in Fallujah.
That's exactly right. But what we keep coming back to is the fact that no matter where you turn, no matter what issue you uncover, we simply keep coming up against one basic fact of life alluded to by a very, very recent Defense Science Board report, and that is that we don't have enough people in uniform for the long haul.
Before we talk about that word that begins with a D, draft, let's hold that for a second. But what starts to happen when people are as discouraged as we're hearing about, for instance, the long tours of duty? We're seeing reports, for instance, of a battalion of soldiers in the Guard from South Carolina, but at Fort Dix in New Jersey, that were in a lockdown last week because some of them started to go AWOL to try to see their families. They were battling each other. They were put on an accelerated training schedule to try to, you know, bring fresh troops to Iraq. And these people never thought they would be doing that.
I think that's right. And the problem with it is the fact that what you run up against, there are some very, very disturbing indicators. And we need not ignore them. We need not put too great a significance on them just yet. But as these things tend to repeat themselves over time, we are beginning to come to grips, I hope, with a trend, which is the fact that you cannot continue to use the reserves for purposes for which they were never intended. Going all the way back to the Minutemen at Lexington and Concord, the presumption of the reservist has been the fact that he or she does not serve on extended active duty for long periods of time, particularly overseas, unless there is an urgent national necessity.
There's a report in USA Today that members of the individual ready reservists, these soldiers who have retired and were then involuntarily called to duty, are failing to show up.
It's very, very hard to escape a very tentative but very, very powerful conclusion, which is the fact that we are about 3 years overdue from looking at the problem in all of its many dimensions. And all of its many dimensions means looking at every single alternative, from the draft to other things that can hopefully get your manpower up to where it needs to be.
Do you really think so? I mean, there are some bills pending calling for a reinstitution of the draft, but most feel there's no way either candidate right now is going to even broach that. Do you think that's going to have to happen, really?
Robin, you got to remember the fact that I have an unusual qualification to talk about this issue. I was drafted. I vividly remember that, and I did not particularly appreciate the experience, even though I served 28 subsequent years in the Army. You don't like to see that because we have put an awful lot of our stake in having a volunteer force. An awful lot of its professionalism is tied up with the fact that it is indeed a volunteer force. But where you come back to in the end, it seems to me, is that as Charles Moskowitz, one of our most brilliant military sociologists, puts it, he says, we have the GI Bill, but without the GI. The problem with this is the fact that we have only tended to look at this thing as if we're back all the way in the 19th century again and saying that, hey, the draft is the only way that we can raise these armies. There are other ways to do this.
Can you give us a few examples?
Yeah, well, I mentioned the fact that we have the GI Bill without the GI. What that means is that we have a great many incentives for education, and it's well that we do so. But what we do not do is to require anybody to do anything for those privileges. And a lot of people have suggested that maybe it is time that we rethought, a GI Bill for the 21st century, because people still have problems meeting their educational tuition obligations and requirements, and maybe that is one way to do this. I mean, there are just lots of different ways. The services themselves have done part of that, because you notice how many people are brought into the services based on a contracting basis. Maybe it's time that we began to rethink that kind of balance.
You mean privately contract out for soldiers?
We do that right now.
Well,
that,
you're
fact,
right.
That's
right.
What Kellogg, Brown, and Root, and Halliburton, that's exactly what they do. And that tends to keep, those calls for more active duty soldiers down to the minimum.
Talking about armed security guards. Well, Dr. Kenneth Allard teaches national security issues at Georgetown University. When we come back, we're going to continue our conversation on troop strength, and we're going to be joined by a former National Guardsman who says, why bother joining the Guard if you end up in combat just like regular forces? Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. We've been speaking with Dr. Kenneth Allard. He's at his home in Alabama. He's a former soldier who teaches national security issues at Georgetown University. We've been talking about U.S. troop strength, recruitment, and the changing nature of reservists and guardsmen. We're going to speak with a guardsman in just a moment. But first, Dr. Allard, how has the fact that the guardsmen are serving overseas affected their ability to do what they were originally intended to do?
Well, Robin, I served in Bosnia with members of the Guard and Reserve. I was very proud to have had that experience. But, down here in the Gulf Coast of Alabama, 2 weeks ago, we had an encounter with Hurricane Ivan. I traveled very extensively to the northern part of Alabama, and I saw what the Guard was doing. They were providing the immediate reaction, food, fuel, ice, everything else that, were absolutely required by the people up there because they've been hit. They've been hit very hard. They've been devastated. And you simply can't have the Guard and the Reserve reach out and do those jobs that the Founding Fathers intended for them to do if they're off in Iraq and off in Afghanistan. We are robbing Peter to pay Paul. What we absolutely have got to do is to figure out how we are going to use the active and the reserve components, recognizing the fact that all of those particular components have other things that they've got to do as their main missions.
Dr. Kenneth Allard, Adjunct Professor of National Security Studies at Georgetown University, thank you.
Thanks, Robin.
Well, as we said earlier, there was a 5,000-person shortfall in enlistment for the National Guard this year. Now, Guard officials say this is partly because the government has enacted stop-loss orders. That means that troops who are deployed must stay with their unit as deployment is extended. Another reason they gave, fewer active duty and former soldiers are opting to switch to part-time Guard duty, knowing that what used to be a stateside stint is now more likely to mean a trip to Iraq. Dave Bischel served in the military a decade ago. He signed up for the Guard in January of 2003 under a program called Try One, which allows veterans to try the Guard service for a year. At the time, he thought he'd be helping out with natural disasters in his home state of California. But as you'll see, that's not how things turned out. Dave joins us on the line from his home in the San Francisco area. And Dave, to be clear, this was all before the war in Iraq. Did you have any expectations you'd be sent into combat?
The way it was explained to me was the two things coming in here. I was out for almost 10 years, so I wasn't exactly up on all my combat training. My recruiter told me that our company was at 160% capacity, and that, you know, if I were to go anywhere, it would be to backfill for units, active duty units. For example, if an active duty MP unit left Fort Lewis, Washington, mm-hmm. we would go to Fort Lewis, Washington to backfill their duties. Yeah. As MPs on the post there.
And then suddenly you find yourself being shipped off to Iraq.
Oh, sure. I came back in January of 03, and by March 04, that's when we got deployed for 13 months, and by May of 03, I was all boots on the ground in the Middle East.
How long were you there?
11 months.
And how did that go? Were you told you were going to be there for 11 months? Or?
No. We were told we were going to be there for 6 months. And that we'd be home by Christmas. And then we got extended three times.
Dave, obviously this was discomfort for you. It upset your life. It derailed you from what you were doing. But what else did it do to have other guardsmen like yourself in Iraq when they didn't expect to be there?
I was in Najaf and Karbala, Baghdad, Abu Ghraib, all the hot spots. We were there patrolling in Najaf, kicking in doors, going on raids for 4 weeks before we even had bulletproof vests. It was pretty intense, and eventually we did get them. A lot of our equipment was archaic, so we were there with the idea in mind we're going to be home by Christmas, and we have old first-generation Humvees that kept breaking down. We had old Singar radios where we couldn't even communicate with it. We were under the 1st Marine Division, and if we were ever out on patrol and needed backup, we were unable to contact them because our radios were so old and they were unable to communicate with the Marines. We wouldn't be able to call for support, combat support. Yeah, the morale dropped, and I know of a Army medic who's currently going to write a book called Prozac Army, and there are a lot of people. The depression became a huge issue. I saw people constantly arguing, people losing their military bearing, a lot of throwing equipment around, yelling. I saw people getting carried away and manhandling various Iraqis we come across in raids, and it just started totally. People became angry, and a lot of people were on various types of drugs like Prozac, Paxil. They had to call in the combat stress management team.
What is your biggest concern about how the National Guard is being used now?
Well, I feel that as a National Guardsman, I was exploited, and I personally, after doing my try 1 year, I'm absolutely not interested in having anything to do with the National Guard.
What happens now for you, Dave? You're back. Is there a chance you can be sent back into combat?
No, because see, when I was prior service, how the military works it now, for example, I was in from 89 to 93, and then following my 4 active duty years, I had 4 years of individual ready reserve where they could have called me back. I fulfilled that a while ago, and so I have no IRR time connected to my try one wonderful year in the National Guard, so they can't call me back.
What would you tell somebody who might be considering National Guard service today?
Well, if you're considering National Guard service, you should consider going active duty because that's what you're going to be doing. We're going to be in Iraq for a long time if we're going to make any headway there. And so if you're going into the Guard thinking you're going to be part-time 1 week in a month, 1 month a year, you should seriously consider the fact that you're going to be going active duty.
Dave Bischel is a military veteran and a former National Guardsman. He spoke to us from his home in the San Francisco area. Tomorrow on Here and Now, we're going to take a look at some of the cases before the Supreme Court this term on the docket, a case about medical marijuana, and two cases that revisit the issue of federal sentencing guidelines. That's tomorrow. Stay with us. More ahead Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And as you by now probably know, political strategists say the outcome of this year's presidential election will be largely determined by voters in the so-called battleground states. Today, we begin a series of weekly conversations about the mood of those much-sought-after voters. We're going to start with Pennsylvania and Florida. Of the swing or battleground states, these two have the most Electoral College votes. Here Now's Bob Oakes spoke today with David Shribman, executive editor at the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette in Pennsylvania, and Adam Smith, political editor at the St. Petersburg Times in Florida.
Adam, let me ask you, first of all, what do the latest polls say about Floridians' attitudes toward the presidential candidates?
Well, with all these hurricanes we've had in Florida, there's a lot good reason to be suspect that some of these polls are suspect. We have anywhere from 8 points advantage for Bush to a 4 point or 1 point advantage for Bush. And both campaigns are still doing their internal polling, and they're both calling it a toss-up.
I can't help but wonder, as billions in federal aid flow to Florida in the wake of the hurricanes, whether or not Floridians are getting angry with the federal response to the hurricanes or whether they're satisfied with the way the Bush administration has handled the situation so far.
Well, we did some polling that's a few weeks old, and initially the response, the reaction from the public has been very favorable to the state and federal reaction. It's an open question how well they react as the checks start coming in. You're already getting some headlines about people unhappy with the size of their checks and that sort of thing. So that's really an open question.
And if there's no great improvement in life in Florida in the next few weeks, that could also be a potential pitfall.
Well, there's a lot of speculation that this could have an effect on turnout in November. And in fact, if you look at where the hurricanes have gone, they've really hurt more Republican dominated counties than Democratic dominated counties. And in the last week or so, I'm hearing Republicans start to at least have some anxiety about whether it could have an impact on all the people that are displaced.
David Shribman, what do the polls currently suggest about Pennsylvania voters?
Well, they suggest that this is an extremely close race, and the presence of these candidates every time you turn around seems to affirm that. President Bush has been here 5 times in the last month. He's been here more than my mother and my mother-in-law. We can be grateful for some of that.
Put your mother and your mother-in-law on the ballot, I guess. John Kerry, when he was recently in Pennsylvania, pointed out that last week the Bureau of Labor Statistics announced that Pennsylvania lost another 1,200 manufacturing jobs in August, which means that since Mr. Bush took office, almost 75,000 jobs have been lost in Pennsylvania. Is the economic issue playing well for him there, or is it all about Iraq?
The economic issue is, I think, the primary issue here. The economy has not rebounded, or certainly hasn't rebounded with a great sense of robustness. People are worried about the economy. They're, of course, worried about Iraq. But the economic issue is a very strong issue here. It's a long-term issue, to be fair to the president, so he can't be blamed fully for it. But he's the guy in charge, and he's the guy who's supposed to turn things around. And so he'll have to be careful on that particular issue.
Are these polls going to tighten as we get closer to Election Day, 5 weeks from today?
Gosh, I don't know how much tighter they can get. And I don't know how many times the president can come to Pittsburgh, but we'll be glad to have him. And we'll be glad to have the polls tighten, because it brings more attention to the issues people here in southwestern Pennsylvania care about.
Adam Smith, beyond the hurricanes, what's the issue in Florida?
Well, it's the same issues you see nationally. It's terrorism, Iraq, health care, and the economy. Even though Florida has done relatively well on the economy compared to most of the other battleground states, we've actually been leading the country for most of the year in job growth. But it's the quality of jobs that's still under debate, and you still hear the sort of questions about the middle-class squeeze in Florida.
I'm wondering how important both of you think the debates that start Thursday night are in the minds of your voters. And David Shribman, let me ask you that question first.
Well, we in the press always say these debates are important, and historically there's some evidence to suggest they're a little important. But what other landmarks are there on the road between now and November 2nd? So we had better pay attention to that one. I can't tell you that the election will be won or lost on Thursday night. I've been reading recently that fewer historians feel that Nixon lost the 1960 election in the debates in that year. So I think these can be overrated, but their potential is still strong.
Adam Smith, will Floridians be paying attention?
Well, we're just in this surreal situation in Florida with all these hurricanes that parts of Florida very well won't be paying any attention at all. And in fact, at the Republican convention, we had a hurricane hit that for two of the biggest TV markets, there was no coverage of the Republican convention. It was all weather all the time. And you're surely going to see some of that on Thursday still.
Let me ask you a question about the language we might hear on Thursday night in the debate, and whether you think language will impact how voters in your states make the decision should they be undecided at this point. Kerry's been saying recently, for example, that the president continues to live in a fantasy world of spin regarding the situation in Iraq. And the Bush campaign has been saying if you blink, when things get hard, you're not going to win the war on terror, and preaching defeat and retreat is bad for the troops and the country. And it's, of course, referring to John Kerry when it makes that statement. If the language is that tough coming out of the candidates' mouths on Thursday night, how will voters react back at home? I ask the question because it's one thing to use language like that when you're at a rally in any town, USA, using that language in front of crowds of your supporters, but it's a whole different situation to use tough language before a television audience consisting of undecided voters you're trying to reach. Isn't that right, David Shribman?
Yes. You can't use language that seems discordant to the people who are sitting in a living room, comfortable, leaning against pillows, maybe shoes off. And if you see a guy going off with a red face and anger, he's going to look kind of silly. But then again, you can't be beaten up like a pincushion either. So you have to kind of be somewhere in between. And I'll just give you them all one piece of advice. Whatever you do, don't look at your watch and don't sigh.
Adam Smith?
Well, yeah, but on the other hand, Kerry's got to do something. I mean, right now the landscape looks a little tough for him if you look at these state polls. So he's got to do something to change the dynamic. So I guess it's a trick of being tough but not strident.
Adam Smith, political editor at the St. Petersburg Times, and David Shribman, executive editor of the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. They spoke with Here Now's Bob Oakes. As always, we welcome your thoughts on the program. Send us an email at letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org. Or you can call our listener line and leave us a message at 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397. Please tell us how to pronounce your full name and the town you're from. Still to come, where can the undecided voter go when they need solid, reliable information about candidates? One resource is called Project Vote Smart. You're listening to Here and Now. Yesterday on Here and Now, we joined a group of Haida Indians as they reclaimed the remains of their ancestors from a Chicago museum. Today, producer Alan Cockle takes us to Canada's Pacific Coast as the Haida rebury those remains. We join the funeral procession as it passes totem poles and travels to the village of Skidegut, stopping en route to hear about a remarkable cultural and political resurgence.
In the weak afternoon light, the long procession to the cemetery begins. Chief Chikal leads the way in wolf crown and ermine fur. The other chiefs fall in behind, and then the singers and the rest. Many wear their woven cedar hats, their family crests across their shoulders draped in red and black. They clutch the boxes to their chest. Their ancestors in bentwood cedar boxes draped in cedar boughs. Andy Wilson built them under an awning by his house.
This is the bentwood boxes, the same as the way they used to make them in the old days, to either be storage for clothing or food, or for our purpose, they used to bury the ancestors in these bigger ones.
Each is fashioned from a single cedar plank, steamed and bent.
There you go.
It's an old skill, passed down like the Haida songs Wilson learned, back when singing was subversive.
One of the things my grandfather did was he would have people watching outside his house there, because we weren't allowed to gather like that to learn those song and dances. So that was around 1956, 57. So there was a whole different flip in there, how people perceive Native people. When my daughter came home and she started singing and dancing, the emotions just came out of inside me, you know. I started crying, and that was just too overwhelming for me.
The procession moves along between the tidy houses and the sea. It files past the famous dogfish totem pole, its frog and bear and man, its wooden watchman's silent gaze. 6 dozen poles once lined this shore, but for most of a century, just this one was raised. The carver's granddaughter, Nika Collison, knows today that things have changed.
This is all just 200 years ago that Europeans first got here, and it was in the mid-1800s that we went from way over 10,000 people to under 1,000. Then there's some missionaries and residential school and just a lot of devastation, alcohol, all that. It's the story. It's all over the world this happens. So we're just ready to do it now. We're the generation that inherited that right to make things better.
It's Guja singing now. The name means drum. The elected president of the Haida, a politician by day, artist by night, he spends his evenings in the carving shed.
This is the upper part of the pole. It has to be round. So while there might be some people who kind of gasp and say, you mean to say they killed a 500-year-old tree just to carve it up? Well, that's true, but at the same time, it's through this art we protected about half of this island because of the cultural need for cedar.
Guja looks to the courts for the next victory. Because the Haida never signed a treaty, they've sued the government for title to the islands, the forests, and the nearby sea.
We want to be sure that in the future we know exactly what old forest will still remain and the integrity of the watersheds to produce clean water for the spawning salmon, for example.
In Skidegut, the parade has reached its end. Gujaw sings again above the grave. And then the shovels do their work, and the people retrace their steps, and the ancestors rest in peace. And tonight, at last, there is a feast.
Producer Alan Cockle. For more on the Haida Indians, visit our website, here-now.org. More ahead, Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. There's no shortage of information available about political candidates. Between TV ads, newspaper articles, political documentaries, late-night comedy, it's harder to avoid the campaign season than participate in it. But the problem, say many voters, is not the amount of information, it's the quality of it. And that's where Project Vote Smart comes in. This nonpartisan, nonprofit organization offers voters a library of information about every candidate running for Congress or Senate, and at the state level for representative, Senate, and governor. While all the information, including campaign finance issues and voting information, is posted on the web, those without computers have equal access by calling a toll-free phone number.
My name is Emily Leader, and you're calling Project Vote Smart.
Hi, I'm looking for information about Representative Alan B. Monahan of West Virginia.
Okay, hold on one second, please. Okay, we have the following areas of information available on Representative Monahan. We have biographical information, issue position through the National Political Awareness Test, campaign finance, interest group rating.
Richard Kimball, a former Arizona State Senate representative, is a founder of Project Vote Smart and its current president. He joins us in the studio. Welcome.
It's great to be here.
Here's one thing that I just love about this organization that I just learned from you, that in order to be on the board, the people that run this organization, you have to have an enemy and bring your enemy along?
It's pretty much accurate. We pair everybody with a political opposite, and we joke that you can't look at our founding board without hating at least a couple of us. Jerry Ferraro joined with Newt Gingrich, Goldwater with McGovern a few years ago. Carter and Ford served 6 years on our board. We do that to emphasize that this is not a political advocacy organization in any way.
Okay, just sum up for us, how does it work? I mean, we've been on the website. You can go and find out information about somebody running for office, but give me more.
Basically, we are a huge national library. As a matter of fact, there's 2,000 libraries now sporting this all over the country. Basically, we use students and interns from universities all over the country to collect enormous amounts of factual data on political candidates, 40,000 of them, from state legislature up to the presidency of the United States. We force them, with or without their cooperation, to fill out an application of employment, just the way all the rest of us do when we apply for jobs. That's what they're doing, applying for a job, and that's what we force them to do. We collect all their background, their education, their history, their professional careers. If they've had the job before, we collect all of their voting records and situate it in a way that laymen can get at it without knowing bill numbers and bill title to get at the subjects they're interested in. We collect even the performance evaluations done on them by what we call selfish interests. You got the right to choose groups, the right to life groups, the labor groups, the business groups, the doctors, lawyers, teachers, nurses, the worm growers of America is the most obscure one we ever found. But if somebody does an evaluation, we'll find it and you get to see what they're saying about them. And we interview, or at least we attempt to get the candidates to tell people what they intend to do for them or to them on the issues they'll most likely face if they win. And we interview thousands of them.
Richard, all that work that I almost hate this next thought. How come so many people, I mean, haven't heard of it? I mean, you do all this work.
Well, the reason is very simple. In the early going, we decided, based on the arguments of the students and the volunteers that made it possible, that we would not take corporate foundation or corporate donations. Because we decided not to take that, we can't afford to advertise. Mm-hmm. So basically, I'm running around the country. This is my 20th state in the last 3 months. When people discover there's some place to turn in absolute confidence for the facts about these people that want to run our lives, whether you be a right-wing conservative or a left-wing liberal, they are turning to us in droves for that kind of information. They're frustrated by them. They know that they're being manipulated, and they just want to get the facts.
You know, I don't even know. Which way did you lean when you were in running for office?
I was considered a liberal Democrat in Arizona. There were a few of us out there, not many.
What I find so interesting, then, is that you sat down and kind of came up with this idea with Barry Goldwater.
Well, there was a number of us, but in terms of my involvement, I was became very enthusiastic about notions that ended up becoming Project Vote Smart when I was sitting in Barry Goldwater's office. It was his seat I was running for. I was the Democratic nominee for the U.S. Senate and ended up defeated by a little-known congressman from Mesa, Arizona, by the name of John McCain at the time, who's now on our board and have been a big supporter of what we're trying to do. But in the meeting with Barry Goldwater, I sat there and I was whining to him that we're about to lose this thing, but for all the wrong reasons. They're going to vote against me because the caricature created by my campaign is not nearly as strong as the caricature created for my opponent. I mean, basically what we do to citizens is incredible. We spend all of our time as candidates raising money from people we do not know, and they are purchasing access to us if we happen to win. That's why they're buying in. And then we all spend the money as candidates the same three ways. The first thing we do is we measure you. We measure the public. We measure whether it is they want to purchase in the political marketplace. And we're not wrong. We know what a black voter wants versus a white voter, a man versus a woman, and we tailor these images of ourselves to fit what we know will sell. And the third thing we do, most expensive thing we do, is we buy the TV time necessary to then bombard people with this meaningless emotional nonsense, and whoever does that best wins. Well, that's not what they were discussing 200 years ago in the Constitutional Convention.
Those three thoughts that you were just sharing with us were part of a moment in your life. Was it in the campaign with John McCain?
Yes, it was.
When it says you, you knew I was going to bring this up. When you turned to the cameras during a televised debate, and instead of going with the script, you just sort of poured this kind of thinking out. What did you say?
At the end of that campaign, I was pretty upset about what I had been doing, what it was required of me to be considered a serious candidate. And my campaign team had designed an attack for me to use against my opponent, John, in the closing argument, a pretty vicious attack. And I knew he was an honorable guy, and I wasn't going to do it. And I became very nervous. I remember my legs started shaking behind the podium because I was a pretty young candidate at the time. And suddenly, if I wasn't going to make this attack, I had nothing prepared to say in my clothes. The camera came on. I looked around at the audience. I looked into the camera, and I said essentially those words. I said, "Understand what it is we do to you as candidates." And when I was done with that, there was absolute silence in the audience. I always remembered that because I just looked at it and thought, oh, my God, did I just hang myself? And, of course, I got lost the election. It was not a very effective closing argument, but it meant a lot to me personally when I said it.
Well, it was the end of a political career, but the beginning of Project Vote Smart. The electorate can be thankful for that. Looking at the mudslinging in the current campaign, do you really think that something like this is going to resonate with people who seem to only want to hear about documentaries and,
It's just horrible what's going on in the campaigns. If I want to buy a 30-second ad, I can push people's passions. I can push their fear. But I cannot move a person's mind on an issue facing our society and the options dealing with it in 30 seconds. So as candidates, we no longer even bother trying. And it's why people don't vote anymore. They're sick of it. And the real leadership in a community is much more likely to reside amongst those people that would never behave that way, that would never consider doing that. They would consider it almost dishonorable. And if they do get involved, a person like that, and doesn't behave in the way I've said that we all behave now in politics, they're going to run up against us. Son of a bitch like me, who is willing to go out and collect all that special interest money and has the will to make them look ridiculous, to embarrass them in front of their family and friends. So who wants to do that? Yeah. They just don't get involved anymore.
Well, Richard Kimball, co-founder of Project Vote Smart, what a story. Thanks for sharing it with us, and we'll let people know how they can get involved.
Thanks for having me on.
Richard Kimball, former Arizona State Senate representative and founder and president of Project Vote Smart. To learn more, go to our website, here-now.org. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Get into your radio and join us again. Here and Now. For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.